House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs on Tuesday, March 26, 1991 at 1 p.m. and 1:30 p.m. in Hearing Room F at the State Capitol Building. Today's agenda is a work session on House Bill 2306, 2308, 2181, 2696 from Subcommittee Number 1. Subcommittee 2 will be reporting for a work session on House Bill 2212, 2007, 2937, 2206, and 2207. Subcommittee 3 will report back for a work session on House Bill 2333, 2325, 2326, 2046, 2132, and 2133.
Business Consumer Affairs will come to order, and the first thing we are going to do is open up a work session on House Bill 2306. And Representative Barnes, would you like to just give us a very brief summary of what the committee did with this? And then I think that we need to bring Mr. Brawner back and let him discuss his amendments before the full committee. And then AOI also has a representative here who wants to testify on the bill.
Is that on 2308?
Yes, 2306.
Oh, 2306.
Oh, I'm sorry. 2308, you're right. We will open a work session on 2308.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we held a public hearing on House Bill 2308 last week, and while we thought perhaps that we were ready to recommend a do-pass recommendation to the committee, and we did vote the subcommittee to do that with amendments, I think it would behoove us perhaps to have Mr. Brawner come back up and speak to us a little bit, and perhaps, based upon that, have the gentleman from AOI come up.
No.
Okay. Mr. Brawner, would you please come up?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
For the benefit of those of us who are not on that subcommittee, will we get an overview of this? I can't read this fast enough.
Terry, would you give us just a brief overview on what this is?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2308 exempt certain retail sellers, and assignees from provisions of retail installment contract law. This bill also repeals ORS 83.810. As defined in ORS Chapter 83, retail installment contract means a contract other than a retail charge agreement or an instrument reflecting a sale made pursuant thereto, entered into or performed in this state for a retail installment transaction. Retail installment contract includes chattel mortgage, conditional sale contract, and contract in the form of a bailment or lease if the bailee or lessee contracts to pay as compensation for the use of sum substantially equivalent to or in excess of the value of the goods sold, or if it is agreed that the bailee or lessee is bound to become, or for no other mere nominal consideration, has the option of becoming the owner of the goods upon full compliance with the provisions of the bailment of this lease. House Bill 2308 has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Yeah, Representative Stein and members, I'm going to ask Mr. Brawner to explain the bill briefly to us also and tell us why it's needed, and then also to explain Mr. Ruttlinger's letter to us regarding the bill. What the controversy might have been and how it's been addressed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Brunner with the Oregon Bankers Association. House Bill 2308 is legislatively neutral. It does not change anything. And I doubt that you'll consider very many propositions this session that where that statement can be made. Mr. Ruttlinger's letter I have read and I concur with. His analysis is on point. What we are attempting to do currently, 83.810, current law, says that any retail installment contract or security agreement which complies with the disclosure requirements of Title I of the Federal Consumer Protection Act, which is also known as Truth in Lending, Regulation Z, if you are in compliance with that act, you do not need to comply with the disclosure provisions of the Oregon statute. Now, we have always been uncomfortable as to the constitutional question of this body delegating to the United States Congress its authority, and by saying if you do what the Congress tells you to do, then you are automatically in compliance with state law. there have been, even in this state, case law where that constitutional question has been decided, and you cannot delegate this body's authority. There are several places in the statute that concern us. This happens to be the most important. This was brought to our attention by General Counsel of First Interstate Bank and General Counsel of U.S., saying that we needed to correct this. So what did we do? What did we attempt to do in 2308? First of all, the amendments that were presented to you that the subcommittee has adopted makes it very clear that we're talking only about disclosure provisions. We're not talking about anything else. Secondly, legal aid brought to our attention that the current law seems to negate those disclosures made on the doorstep with home solicitation sales. And obviously, we never thought the current law said that if you're in compliance with Reg Z, you don't need to comply with these verbal disclosures when you're doing telephone solicitation or home solicitation. But the new ORSs contained in the amendments make sure that we don't touch that either. What we do in the statute is use the four qualifiers that makes you subject to Regulation Z. In other words, if you are both as a seller or as a purchaser of retail installment contract, if you regularly enter into retail installment contracts, and if the terms of the retail installment transaction provide for payment of a service charge or finance charge, and with more than four installments, and you have retail installment transactions of 25 or more, those are the, if you do that, no matter what business you're in, banking, anything else, no matter what business you're in, you are subject to Regulation Z. And so you see, we have removed the delegation of this body to the United States Congress. We have, now, it's true, if Regulation Z qualifiers change, then we'll be out of whack, and we'll have to come back and address that, but they haven't changed in 10 years, probably 15 years, so we don't expect them to change. 25 transactions and the other things that are listed there. We've said that if you have those things happening to you, you are subject to Reg Z, but it doesn't say that in the statute, but the federal statute says you are. If those things happen, you need not comply with the disclosure requirements of the state statute, because you must comply with the disclosure requirements of Reg Z. The intent of the legislature when this passed, and I believe it was 1969, the intent was that there would not be conflicting disclosures. You can't comply with the Oregon statute and comply with Reg Z without providing two disclosures and a lot of confusion to the consumer. Now, I suppose that I've thoroughly confused you, but I've attempted to try to explain why this legislatively neutral bill is before you.
Okay, you want to touch on Mr. Rettlinger's letter to, and
the only conflict that I have, Mr. Chair, with the letter, and I don't now have a copy, but I think there's some suggestion that the current statute deals with truth in lending when this statute was passed. I don't find anywhere in the statute where it says that. As a matter of fact, I believe that if the Congress changed truth in lending tomorrow, it would change automatically. It is prospective, as well as, in other words, I think clearly in a court there would be some question as to whether this provision is constitutional.
Okay,
I think his letter talks about
picks up the requirements of the same requirements as the federal legislation, repeats them in state statutes, and therefore requires everybody in the state that.
But the most important thing, Mr. Chair, is it does not refer to truth in lending or Regulation Z or an act of the federal government.
Yes.
It uses the same qualifiers that are currently in existence and have been for a long time.
Let me ask then, if an organization, a business that, or a person making installment contract sales, if they comply with what they consider the federal regulations, as they have been doing for some years, does that exactly, do they then meet the requirements of the proposed legislation because it mirrors the federal legislation?
The 2308 does not change their world at all, and the federal disclosure goes beyond what is required in the state statute. Those, put another way, the state statute has and will deal with those people who do not extend credit over 25 times in a year and do not regularly engage in retail install, do not do these things. And that's the way it is now. The state statute disclosure is required of only those people who do not comply with Regulation Z, and nothing will change.
Okay. Question by committee members. Representative Stein.
Yeah, is there any difference in the sanction or remedy that would apply now?
The sanction and remedy that is involved in Regulation Z is, of course, still there. The sanction and remedy that is involved in the state statute is, of course, still there. Banks will not be subject after this bill passes to the state disclosure, and we are not now, and have not been since, I believe, 1969. All we're concerned about is the cross-reference to a federal statute. We are not changing any part of the operation of any retail installment establishment today, be it financial institution or someone else.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think I understand this.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it was my feeling when we come with this bill that this bill will help consumers from this standpoint. There are a whole lot of the Oregon public, and that includes credit grantors, that don't know the threshold for Regulation Z. And now it will be in the statute. Heretofore, all we did was say, if you're in compliance with this unknown truth in lending Regulation Z, you don't have to do the disclosure. Now, there are people that are subject to Regulation Z that don't know it, and there are also people that are not examined to see if they're in compliance with Regulation Z. Certainly not the people I represent, but there are some. So I think having the current threshold, which hasn't changed, like I say, it's been static, having that threshold in the statute is of benefit because people will know what you have to do when you're subject to the state disclosure and when you're subject to another disclosure.
Is there a mechanism for us to be notified if the Regulation Z changes so that we want to bring this into conformity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stein, I would suspect that one of us that are subject to Regulation Z would be called the mechanism. I doubt seriously that it will that the number of transactions will go down. I doubt seriously that it ever changes. It's pretty well accepted that this is the threshold among all credit grants.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Bowen. Mr. Whitty?
I am Jim Whitty, Legislative Counsel of Associated Oregon Industries and Director of the Oregon Retail Council. I've had my people look at this. They looked at the testimony of the bankers last Thursday, and we are perplexed. We don't understand the constitutional problem. I was presented today with, just a few minutes ago, with Mr. Ruttlinger's letter, with a couple of other letters from the bankers. I'm intrigued by this, by the concept that this statute might be considered, have constitutional problems, although we don't quite understand what the resolution of that is yet. Is being only a few minutes since we've looked at these, since I've looked at these. We do know we do not have a case law on this, or it would have been presented. We don't have the threat of case law. It seems to be addressing something out of somebody's imagination at this point. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's an error. I guess all what I'm asking for is a couple of days so that I could have these letters shown to our credit people, our credit lawyers, and to look at it from our perspective. That's all I would ask at this point.
Okay, question by committee members? Okay, if there are no questions, is it Any further comments by committee members at this point? Okay, if not, we'll close the work session, and Terry, please put it back on for Thursday. Okay, we will now open a work session on House Bill 2306. Jerry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We would like to have that bill back in subcommittee. We had thought we'd hold a work session next Tuesday on this. Information I received this morning would indicate that the motor vehicles, the manufacturer's representative and the representative of the Auto Dealers Association perhaps are getting together with some amendments to that bill. So I would like to have it re-referred back to the committee if possible. Subcommittee.
Okay, committee members, I apologize for not having Terry give us a rundown of what we're talking about. I'll try to do that in the future.
Okay, you don't have to hear it now. Yeah. Who cares?
It is a somewhat controversial bill dealing with the price of auto dealerships as compared to the manufacturer. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2306, and Terry, please send that back to the subcommittee member. Okay, we will now open the work session on House Bill 2212. And Terry, would you just give us a brief rundown on what 2212 is?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2212 is pre-session filed at the request of the Department of Insurance and Finance. This bill limits the claim responsibility of the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association to Oregon residents and certain non-residents. Briefly, the background, the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association is funded by assessments on insurance companies. When a life or health insurance company fails, other insurers contribute to the guarantee fund to compensate for claims of the insured. These other insurers receive tax credits in return for their contributions to the fund. Therefore, limiting the claims responsibility of the Guarantee Association will reduce the tax credits against the general fund and increase general fund revenues. And should have in your files the Hannah Gross version of House Bill 2212 with the amendments. Mr. Lewis Littlehales from the Insurance Division is here. The committee would like those amendments explained in further detail.
Okay. Representative Stein, would you like to take over this point?
Sure. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, this bill is somewhat complex, so we may want the assistance of Lewis Littlehales from the department, but I just want to set a framework for you, is that the original theory on which this bill was, the guarantee fund was based, is that all states would adopt legislation that would accept liability for insolvent insurance companies in-state or out-state. So the idea was it didn't matter where you were, that you were going to get compensated because all states would agree to compensate you if you were in-state or out-of-state. As it's turned out, that was a National Association of Insurance Commissioners standard. As it turned out, although 48 states or 47, depending on who you talk to, it seems here, have these guarantee funds, 34 of them cover their residents only. So the trend is now switched, and the national standard is now to go to only covering residents with for claims. And so what the bill before you does is to move in this new direction, which is to say that we aren't going to compensate out-of-state claimants when an insurance company goes bankrupt, with some exceptions in order to protect people better. Only Oregon residents who are insured by Oregon and out-of-state insurers would be covered by this guarantee fund, which is a sort of a reinsurance mechanism in a way. Non-residents would be covered if there is a similar type of guarantee association in the non-resident state and the person is not eligible for coverage by that association, and there are a couple other ones. This also extends the coverage that's covered by this guarantee fund to unallocated and annuity contracts of government employees. It caps the amount of that the guarantee fund is responsible for in terms of individual claims and total sort of stop loss kind of claim of up to $5 million per company that's insolvent. One of the nice things about this for us, in view of our financial situation, is because this, the amount that insurance companies pay into this assessment fund is tax credit, there'll be less paid into the assessment fund because they're going to have potentially fewer claims to pay out because we won't be covering non-residents. So potentially there's up to somewhere around a $10 million benefit to the general fund from avoiding the tax credit losses that we would incur otherwise. The bill is supported by this guarantee association and the life insurers, as we heard in our subcommittee, and our subcommittee does recommend to the full committee that we pass this, so we do pass recommendation with the amendments that were proposed by the department.
Very good. Representative Stein. Any questions?
Is there, Representative Stein?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Was there any opposition to this bill? In your
there was none expressed.
Representative Martin.
Is there any likelihood of retaliation by any of our states in the adjoining area?
34 of our.
Actually, this is the national trend now to go this, and California and Washington have similar provisions to what we have, so it looks like we're protected on two sides.
Any questions or comments? Okay, Representative Stein moves the proposed amendments to House Bill 2212, LC 1084, dated 3/26/91. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, Representative Stein, would you like to move the bill?
I would move House Bill 2212 to the. Does this go to revenue first, did we say? Or?
Hearing? What can you tell us about a subsequent referral?
There was no original subsequent referral assigned to the bill.
Since it doesn't affect revenue, I think that we should recommend a referral, subsequent referral to revenue.
Okay, then I would move that House Bill 2212 be referred on to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Looks like Lewis.
Lewis, uncomfortable with that?
He doesn't like that.
It's already been the judiciary.
Introduce yourself, Lewis, and give us a hand here.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lewis Little-Hales, and with me is Charles Nikoloff, both in the insurance division. Regarding the $10 million, I think I'd like to clarify that point. The insurers are assessed only when there is an insolvency. There is no fund until there is an insolvency for so there. There really isn't. For example, if you had a company that went under with $15 million in claims that needed to be paid out, and out-of-state claims, total out-of-state and in-state, and under the current law, all $15 million would have to be assessed, and there would be the tax set-off against the general fund of the $15 million. Let's say only $5 million of those were Oregon residents. Well, under the new law, only $5 million would be assessed against members, and $5 million would be assessed against the general fund. So there's no the benefit against the general fund is what is not assessed, or is not written off, or not written off.
Okay, well, what do you do in terms of the governor's budget then, in estimating what the credit, tax credit, might be? In any biennium. It looks like we'd have a reduction in the tax credit.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
What do you do in terms of estimating what this might be for the governor's budget?
Well, you'd have to make an estimate as to how many insolvencies we're going to have, and we've never been asked to do that. So
never been asked to do it?
No.
Okay. All right. So you're not, it's not included in any way, even as an estimate in the governor's budget at the present time?
Not either. That I'm aware of. Are you?
I'm not aware of it. Because, you know, in our fiscal impact, we said that there was no fiscal impact.
Well.
And when we proposed that bill was really part of the governor's, would have been included.
Mr. Chair, I'm just reading this, the fiscal office, and there is a statement down here Says, as a rough approximation, the agency estimates assessments against the general fund due to total receiverships in 1991-93 is expected to be $13.6 million. Have you gentlemen...
Mr. Chairman, I have not seen it, but any assessments that are going to be levied because of prior insolvencies are not affected by this bill. It's only new insolvencies. Since we're already stuck covering non-residents, that what you just read is true. But if the bill were to become law, any new assessments will only be levied because of Oregon residents. So the savings is in the future. It should have no effect on prior insolvency. No effect on the general fund because of prior insolvencies.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, I'm going to accept the motion as made, and if we do need to make a change to that, we can do it under propositions and motions on the floor. But it would appear at this time that there is some revenue impact, potentially, and that it should go to revenue for their perusal. Okay, further discussion on the motion? The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Barnes?
Aye.
Nato?
Aye.
Oakley?
Aye.
Stein?
Aye.
Walden?
Aye.
Reichen? Mr. Chair?
Aye. Motion passed. Representative Reichen is excused. Terry, will you please check a little further on the fiscal impact?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Impact?
Okay, we will now open a work session on House Bill 2937. While Terry's making his notes, this deals with clothing that is left at dry cleaning and laundry establishments and have not been picked up, and gives the owners a method of disposing of the articles. Anything to add now, Terry?
Mr. Chair, you have in your file the questions came up at the subcommittee hearing regarding the proposed language for amendments to this bill that you have before you. If you had a chance to review those or...
Okay, Representative Stein, would you like to...
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2937 was heard in our subcommittee, and we had John Craig, president of the Oregon Dry Cleaners Association, from LeGrand, speaking on behalf of it. What appears to be the situation is that right now for a laundry establishment, a launderer or dry cleaner, to be able to sell or get rid of goods that have been left for a long time, you have to go through the chattel possessory chattel statutes, which are really structured to deal with getting rid of things that have real value. And for the most part, dry cleaners tend to, although the clothes are of value, they tend to either give them away or sometimes they do sell them, but a lot of times they don't have a lot of value, so they tend to just keep them around to avoid having to go through the process of the possessory chattel lien statute, which is ORS Chapter 87. So they presented us with a bill that we evaluated and have some recommendations of some amendments. The amendments were not considered officially by the subcommittee, so we're sort of in the process here of dealing with them. What the original bill indicated is that if there was a garment left with a dry cleaner, it could be redeemed, and it was not redeemed within 90 days. Then it could be disposed of at a sale if the dry cleaner notified people by certified mail at their last address. And then it further indicated that they could redeem, if the clothing was not redeemed within 180 days, they could get rid of the articles or garments without notification. We kind of thought it made sense to simplify this a little bit, since the whole point of this was to simplify the procedure. And the whole thing of certified mail can cost up to $10, and it's a bother for people who are running a small business. So what we are proposing is that we amend House Bill 2937 by deleting subsection 1 of section 1, basically deleting lines 5 through 10, and starting with basically using that subsection 2 as the main part of the bill. And let's see here. indicating that the dry cleaner would be able to dispose of the goods after 180 days, but the amendment indicates they would have to be a letter mailed just first class, indicating that the person had up to 30 days from the date of the letter to reclaim their goods. This is something I added in after the subcommittee, so I have to indicate that I added this because I felt that due process really demands notice no matter what, and that this was that we need to have some kind of notice requirement here. Also added a section that would require the retail dry cleaner to post a notice indicating that if the clothes were not picked up within 180 days, they may be disposed of following a notice by first-class letter. We picked that up from another state that has a similar statute. Apparently, in other states, there's quite a wide range here everywhere, I think from 30 or 60 days to a year, that dry cleaners have to keep clothes before they can dispose of them. So that's where we stand.
Okay. Real good job, Representative Stein. Any questions on the amendments or the bill?
I just have a question, Mr. Chair,
Representative Walden.
Relative to the notice provision. I know the answer, too, but what happens in the instance where they don't have an address, they just have a name?
Representative Stein, would you please?
Well, it says last known address. I think what this would indicate that technically what a dry cleaner needs to do is get people's addresses if they intend to use this provision. I don't have the possessory chattel lien statutes. I wonder if we might want to address this. I suspect in the lien statutes, knowing that they are very old, that they probably address this issue of some kind, because they're very complicated and old, and they probably have some kind of indication that if you don't know the address, you can publish in your local newspaper, etc. Although I haven't read it, I suspect that might be there. So I guess technically either we have to include some way of